are listening to Radio Influence.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome into the Landry Football Podcast for this Thursday, June 4th. First of all, hope you all are safe and well. Had a different show planned for the day. I had some things I wanted to talk about. And some ideas. Even sometimes I do, I'll write down in my notebook, hey, I'd like to talk to the audience about this and that. And there are a few things that I wanted to talk about. But, you know, sometimes things happen that you feel compelled to not only talk about something that is maybe along the lines of what other people are thinking, but almost if you don't really address it, you feel like you're putting your head in the sand and you're ignoring something that's just so blatantly obvious. So I'm going to get to a few things today. I'm going to talk a little bit about, and in some ways they're tied together, some ways they're parallel thoughts, but nonetheless, I want to talk about what's going on in our world today and how maybe sports is affected, can affect society, how it ends inside. We've got Drew Brees' situation that's blown up over the last 24 hours. We got a situation at Florida State where the head coach is having to explain some what he did or didn't do. Still don't know yet. We're going to get into that. But then I also wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of guys that I thought were really instrumental in the world of college football that passed away this week. We lost Pat Dye, longtime Auburn coach. Have some stories on Pat on Monday. And then we lost Johnny Majors. Pat was 80 years old, died as a result of some kidney failure issues, and he did contract the coronavirus as well. Johnny Majors, longtime Tennessee coach, great University of Pittsburgh coach, two-time Pittsburgh coach. The first time, of course, was the more celebrated one where he and Jackie Sherrill and that staff built a power in the unlimited signing class days and the great teams, the national championship team in 1976, as well as some other good teams they had. We're going to talk about that, as well as maybe talk about some other coaches and some stories and what could have been, because I've got a unique story that I've told on a couple of platforms about Pat Dye, but I want to get into a little bit more detail than I have been able to do it. But let's get into what has kind of made the news and maybe kind of changed things over the past 24 hours is some thoughts about Drew Brees, somebody that I know, somebody that I think a great deal of. And quite frankly, there has maybe Peyton Manning to some degree, but even with the situation when he was at Tennessee, that didn't amount to a whole lot of he said, she said, maybe some negativity. But Drew Brees, I can't think of someone that has been more revered, looked up to, and squeaky clean image more than he. And you know by now, unless you've been under a rock, if you don't, I'll say it. He was asked, and I don't really know what context. I didn't hear the whole interview because I've not been able to get a hold of the whole interview. But he was discussing things related. And this is where sometimes hearing part of it is, and I went back and looked at the transcript and everything. What you say matters. What you mean in what you say are sometimes very different. We don't think enough about what we say in relation to how other people are going to feel when you say it. I'm guilty of it. I'm raising my hand. We all could do better. Drew Brees, I think, he is not perfect. He's not, no one's squeaky clean perfect. He's a good guy. he's proven to be the epitome of a football player on and off the field and a great teammate. But here's an example, and I want to take this example. Here's someone that passionately, in his myopic view, grandparents served in the war, grew up with unbelievable admiration of veterans. He has put in tons of money in the new veterans facility in New Orleans, the museum, and countless other things. So for him, the saluting of the flag, the reverence of it, means probably as much to him as anything. It represents his grandparents and all that's near and dear to him. So to him, it's offensive if somebody doesn't stand at attention for the national anthem, salute the flag. And don't know if he was taking a shot recently at Colin Kaepernick, but certainly addressed in a roundabout way that we knew what the intent was, to suggest that that is not something that I cannot condone anybody doing that. Anybody not standing at attention for the flag. Thus, 4 years ago when it happened, and now, not condoning what Colin Kaepernick did by kneeling. From his eyes, it's offensive to veterans and to the flag. So you can understand, or should understand, that's his view. What Drew did not understand, and perhaps hasn't understood, probably gets it now. I'm guessing he gets it now because he's put out a profuse apology. I'm sure it's because it has been a 24-hour or thereabouts nightmare for him. His whole image is, in the eyes of many, tarnished. Respect level, maybe to some, significantly less than what it was. Regardless of which side you take on that, that's your view. A lot of people think he just doesn't get it. A lot of those people, black players in his locker room, black players in the league. What Drew did was not take into effect how his viewpoint, while that's the way he feels about him, himself, does not put himself in the shoes of someone else in how they feel. And the appropriateness or the lack of appropriateness of the comments, where he was not talking, people would say, to say that Colin Kaepernick shouldn't have done that. Well, for you, that may be fine. But from where he stood, he's not standing in somebody else's shoes. The issue with Colin Kaepernick when it came out, I admit, my first reaction was, I don't like anybody kneeling for the national anthem. You're disrespecting the national anthem and the flag. Well, it was ignorance, because what he was trying to do, Colin Kaepernick, was show some form of protest against how blacks are being treated by policemen. Well, how prophetic is he now 4 years later? I mean, everybody wants to hail Colin Kaepernick now. Let's sign him. Let's just sign him so he can kneel and show us our error of our ways. I mean, my God, he had it right. Not right for me, but right for him and right for the black community. And that in and of itself needs to be understood. You may not agree with it. That's that. Now, if it were me and I were telling, I would have said, why don't you get all of your teammates together and say, because they did this after, if you notice, why don't we all get together and kneel before the national anthem or after the national anthem for just 5 seconds? And people are going to, everyone's going to notice that. Both teams, that would have gotten a lot of notice. What Colin did is he did it on himself. He certainly paid the price for it. But he has a right to protest, a peaceful protest. And as I alluded to, sure a hell of a lot better than busting windows, store windows, and looting, which we know that most of the protesters are not looting. It's a different element that's using it as an excuse, or a third element that is there to create chaos in our society. Now, what Drew learned is, There's nothing wrong with his view for him, but he doesn't walk in other people's shoes. And as much as he's a great teammate and someone that is probably there for his teammates, you know, it shows that even there's a divide. And one of the things I want to get into is how I do think that the locker room in sports is better than the rest of society, yet we got issues there. And this is a perfect example. Will this be an issue in the Saints locker room this year? It could be. Depends on how Drew handles it and how the other players react to it. What it shows, though, is even somebody that is always antenna up to say the right thing, the politically correct thing. Some people may say Lily Wright, goody two shoes. You know, cynics may say that. I think it's genuine, good guy. Even he failed to open his mind to what other people are thinking. I give you an example of something, and I always tend to sometimes I go with what I know. And I want to step back for a second and talk about like something that's not nearly as important, but then I'm going to parallel it. You know, people always say, well, how do you do trades in the NFL? How did you do them? You know, the fan thinks, yeah, go ahead and rake somebody over the coals. You're never going to do a trade like that. The best way to do a trade is to be in somebody else's shoes. Okay, I know that team. I kind of know what would fit them. What would make sense for them and make sense for us? What would we have that wouldn't hurt us but help them? And what do they have that would benefit us and probably not be something that would hurt them so they'd be willing to part with it? When I always stepped into their shoes for a second, said, okay, I'm going to be them. What am I going to do? Now, I'm not saying that I didn't make some trades that became one-sided and because their view of what they liked and what they didn't was a little bit different. Okay, but I tried to do it that way. All right, now I'm back to the reality of things more important. Isn't it the appropriate thing to be more concerned about what you say and what you do and how it's going to affect other people? You know, it may not seem like this is an apt comparison, but if somebody shares with you some bad news, they lost their job, your response initially is going to be what? Empathetic. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Maybe depending on your level of knowing the person, you know, is there anything I can do? Is what like, type of work? I mean, you know, whatever the details you might go into it, but it's going to show empathy. Your response is not going to be, well, you know, I got mine, so yeah. It doesn't bother me. Who would have that response? No one. I lost, you know, a loved one today. Lost my longtime pet today, whatever. Well, I still got mine. Who would, you know, no one would do that because it's so obvious that that's inappropriate and selfish thinking. This is not so obvious to some people, but should it be? Isn't it time we do open up our eyes and say, if somebody's in that much pain, if I see people bothered so much about something and it doesn't appear to be that big of a deal to me, it would behoove me to learn what it is that's that bothering them, why is it bothering them, and is there anything I can do to help or support? I may not get it. It may not affect me, but if it affects someone else, particularly if it's people that you know, but if it's just a whole segment of a population that's affected, we got real issues. And look, I'm a big believer that sports can be an avenue to correct things. You know, the whole, well, we don't care about your opinion. You're not elected official. Now everybody has a right to have an opinion and to have a viewpoint. I challenge you all. Here's the challenge, the coach's challenge. Forget what you think today and find someone to learn their opinion and why. Get their opinion. And don't hear them out. Listen to them. That would be a great lesson. If we all listen to someone else, we'd maybe have a better view of things. it is a key to negotiation. Listen to what they want. Listen to what they need. Listen to what they desire. Listen why. Get your chance to explain your thoughts in negotiations. Well, this is not a negotiation. This is a fundamental issue of living with one another. We're living, and we talk about how great of a country we are. You know what? I think we all appreciate and stand and salute of what a great country it is. But, you know, sometimes as a people, we don't act like it. Sometimes we're not as good as we can be. And maybe that's the coach in me. We may be the best. We're not as good as we can be. I can tell you that. And there are a lot of reasons for it. But do you know what? It comes down to it. It's not about this issue or that issue. Those are issues. Why do we have issues? What is the issues? You don't play well in a game. You don't correct it. You have to know how to correct it. You have to be able to know how to fix it. And what can you do to drill down to make it better to fix it? How do you fix this? You fix it, first of all, by understanding what it is that other people think. Look, I grew up in South Louisiana. We had two school systems in my little town. It really wasn't big enough to have two school systems. You know why we had two? The public school system was for the blacks, and the private school was a Catholic school, and it was for the whites. I had two black girls in my graduating class of like 88. Two of the sweetest girls, Janine and Juwan. I still remember them. God, it's been so many years. I still remember them. So I remember a lot of my classmates. But when I played junior high sports, football, basketball, baseball, high school football, basketball, baseball, I didn't play with black athletes because we didn't have any in our class. It wasn't until I started playing kind of the recreational, where it was not school-related, but what we call biddy basketball and baseball. We didn't have football in the junior high. We played baseball, and I played basketball, and I played with blacks. So I realized that, you know, that's where I had experiences with blacks because I didn't know them before. I didn't really see them. Didn't go to school. And I was like any other kid. You go to school, you go home, you play at school. That's all you know. As you get older, you know, you're playing other sports. You get to know them. You get to like them. You get to know their families. It helped to create an environment. Then I get into going to college. It's a walk-on football player in college. A lot of black athletes become great friends. Nothing can bring you together quite like sports being part of a team. And football requires you to do that. And I think, despite the fact that maybe Drew Brees has realized today that he could do a better job and everybody else could, because if Drew Brees steps out of line and says something that's offensive to somebody, that would be one of the, if you were to ask me what player in the league is going to say something this week that's going to offend his black teammates, I'd probably get through most players before I'd ever even think about Drew Brees. And there it is. And there he goes. Drew Brees is not racist. I don't believe he's racist. I think he's just done too much. I don't believe that's in his heart. I don't know that. Okay. I don't know it. Based on his actions, it would say absolutely not. Based upon his comments, I don't think his comments were racist. I thought they were tone deaf. I thought they were insensitive. I thought they were myopic and overreaction to how it made you feel, how it infuriated you that people would kneel for the national anthem because it made you feel bad without realizing how other things infuriate other people and scare other people, generations of other people, families of other people. Those things are lost on people that don't walk in their shoes. I can't walk into the shoes of somebody that grew up black. I am not ashamed of being white. But if I or any of us can't listen and learn and try to get a feel for what it is that makes them so upset, what it is that they go through. You know, what happened in Minneapolis was beyond repulsive, beyond awful, and everyone of all races, colors, creeds recognizes it. What we tend to maybe not realize is that this has been happening for a long, long time. We're just seeing it now with cell phones. Why is it happening? All cops are bad. No, but there are some bad ones. Well, what do? It's education. It's being more careful. It's being an understanding that this is how you do things, that you treat everybody a certain way. You treat every situation not based upon the color of the skin, but of the circumstances. I certainly have never been a cop, but if I were to see someone that had their hands in their pocket, whether they're white, black, green, purple, red, you better be on the defensive because you don't know what they got in their pocket and you need to be careful. But if they're in handcuffs, and I don't need to be a cop to know that you don't need to put a knee on the neck of someone. That was hate, pure hate, pure lack of care for another human being. That's not someone that should be representing us in any way, shape, or form. There are bad people. There are bad cops. There are bad people in every profession. We're not going to go around life making everybody good, but we need to make people who do bad things accountable. We need to make people who are not good people find a way to figure out what it is that they don't get. What made a guy like that? Is he mentally ill? Is he full of hate? Why is he full of hate? I think a lot of things need to be understood. Why did that guy get through the police academy? You telling me at some point you don't figure out that that guy has got emotional issues, maybe mental health issues, hatred issues? At some point, you got to figure that out. Because the answer is, yeah, after the fact, to put them in jail for the rest of their life. But how about we do something before the fact to prevent this a little bit more? And haven't we been here before? Haven't we been here? It seemed like a few years ago. It seemed like two or three. I know it's been longer than that in Ferguson, Missouri. And obviously, we haven't learned a whole lot. I don't know that anything's gotten any better. Certainly doesn't seem like it. We've got a lot of issues. And maybe it's not more than it's always been. Maybe we're just finding it out more. But there needs to be an emphasis on fixing it. And that's what the story of today is, of this week is. And it's something that needs to be addressed societally, and it's by everyone. No one should do that. And two rights don't make a wrong. We need to lock up people that are looting because they're not doing anything to remember Mr. Lloyd. They're not doing anything to protest. It's a license to steal or to create havoc. That needs to be handled in the appropriate way. And I think we're seeing a lot of this now. I think we're seeing a lot of police that are aligning with protesters, protecting the protesters so that they can be safe and do what they have a right to do. But then you've got to be careful, as we've now lost several policemen, not by protesters, but by thugs, by people involved, people around it. Because I think the good protesters are not the ones doing that. I think that maybe there's some protesters that maybe got too emotional and attacked policemen. I don't know exactly who everyone is and what was in their heart. But I think we all know right from right, wrong from wrong. That's not debatable. What's debatable is how we figure out how to prevent things like this from starting in the first place. We deal with this in the locker room by talking about the team. Best player will play. You do what we ask you to do. This is a family. It's a brotherhood. There's no color here. Now, Vic Fangio, the coach of the Broncos, really, again, he didn't say it the right way. Maybe it wasn't as incendiary, but he got some heat. There's no racism in the NFL. Yeah, there is, Vic. Of course there is. My God. you've been in this league as long as I have. There's racism. There's racism everywhere. There's, you know, there are issues, there are problems. We're all sinners. We're all a work in progress. But I do think that we have a lot of things that we do. And this is what I think Vic meant and didn't say it well. As a locker room, it is colorblind. When it comes time for the team, put the team first, it's colorless. It's colorblind. Is, you know, everybody going to leave the facility and go break bread together and be you know, off? No, you don't have that anyway. You know, you got some married people. You got some, you know, you got some people that, you know, go out with different folks. Some people have cliques. You know, linemen tend to be with linemen. I mean, there's a lot of things. And some of it may be black guys with black guys and white guys with white guys. I said when I was coaching at LSU, one of the things that we had was a lot of black players at LSU would go and party with the students at Southern's campus, because Southern was the largest historically black college enrollment in the country. They went there, and, you know, black guys wanted to meet up with black girls, and, you know, that's what they did. You have a lot of that, but there's still a brotherhood, a friendship. I mean, there's a lot of people that I consider friends. I'm not around them a lot. I'm not a go out to lunch guy and do a lot of that stuff. Doesn't mean we're not friends. You get into ball, you learn to work as a team, and you learn to kind of see this as, you know, best guy versus, you know, the next best guy and not color. But there are things that are subliminal. As we talked about with the Rooney Rule and hiring assistants, you tend to hire people you know the most about. Well, if the people you know the most about are in your same race, you're not exposing yourself to enough people. So maybe you expose yourself to more people and you never know. It opens up the door. Maybe you make decisions that are different. Those people get more opportunities. And it's going to grow organically. But when you shut yourself out to hearing the views, hearing the pain of someone else, it's a problem. I know in college, and we lost a couple of people this week, Pat Dye and Johnny Majors. One of the things that's unique about college football is a little bit of a father figure. A lot of athletes, a lot of black athletes, sometimes with white coaches, and Pat Dye and Johnny Majors are two of them. They're like father figures, and they look at a lot of those guys as their sons. They treat them well. They've done a lot of things for them that a lot of the critics don't ever talk about because they don't know. Helping them maybe get on with life after football and opportunities, basically being a mentor. People have meant an awful lot. You can't dislike somebody and then help them. I mean, you help them, you have a love for them. Does it mean that, you know, somebody like Pat Dye that grew up in rural South Georgia didn't grow up around slavery or knew about it? Yeah, probably saw the injustices. It affects everybody differently. Does he know what it's like to be black? No, but he had the compassion. He had the understanding. Well, not perfect either, but he was open to doing things to help anybody. With the idea that, hey, look, he's going to get good ball players that can win, and he's going to treat them like family. So there are things we can learn. There are things we can grow from mentors and people that are successful in sports often go on to be successful in business because they operate with the idea that let's give people an opportunity. But in order to give people an opportunity, you need to get to know them. In order to get to know them, you need to listen. You need to learn. We live in a world behind a keyboard where we call names and call people out. And, you know, that is not the way to grow as a society properly. So I don't have all the answers. I just say step in somebody else's shoes and understand that if you were affected the way they were affected, you might see things more like they see them. And if that is the case, then why not be empathetic to their plight and recognize that what they are fighting for is not often in contrast to what you want, but maybe they feel the need to express it differently. And maybe you can be there to help somehow, some way. It was, I mentioned Pat Dye. Always remembered Pat Dye's press conference when he got the job at Auburn. He was asked to how long it was going to take to beat Alabama. He said 60 minutes with a South Georgia draw. Pat was a unique guy. Pat was interesting in that he was a Bear Bryant disciple. And I think when he went to Alabama, you know, it was at the, went to Auburn. Bear Bryant was finishing up his career at Alabama. It was, he sounded a lot like the Bear, as did Gene Stallings. And boy, that rankled a lot of Alabama fans. And until Gene Stallings got back, it was that stretch before Coach Stallings got there, after Bear Bryant left and passed away, until Gene Stallings got there, it was not pleasant in Tuscaloosa, because you had Pat, not only did you no longer have Bear Bryant, you had Pat Dye that was more like Bear Bryant than anybody, again, along with Coach Stallings. And he was coaching against your rival. But Pat was, I tell the story all the time, and what could have been, huh? Pat left Alabama's coaching staff. He'd coached at Alabama for 9 years. He went to East Carolina to be the head coach. He was there from 74 to 79. And in 1979, the head coach at North Carolina State was a young, bright Woody Hayes disciple, played running back for Woody Hayes. Bo Ryan had success at NC State, left NC State to replace Charlie McClendon at LSU. Well, Pat Dye wanted the North Carolina State job and was blocked from the job by a booster of East Carolina that also had ties to the NC State program. And it really rankled Pat Dye to the point where he left East Carolina to go to Wyoming. And he spent 1 year at Wyoming, but he always wanted to get back in the South if he could, and particularly the SEC, where he grew up. Pat played offensive guard for Wally Butts at Georgia, and his quarterback was none other than the great Fran Tarkenton. So certainly Georgia would have been a dream job for him. Well, Vince Dooley's at Georgia, and they win the national championship in 1980. Vince had been there in the 70s and did a good job and was the head coach, and it had recruited Herschel Walker, among other great players. They win the national title. Well, at the same time in 1980, Auburn fires Doug Barfield. And Vince Dooley was recruited to come back home to Auburn. Vince Dooley is an Auburn graduate. And it was going to go. I mean, it looked like it was a done deal, and it wasn't in the information age, but that was kind of the word. He was headed to Auburn. Well, Pat begins to really work his angle to try to get the Georgia job. He wanted to go back home to his alma mater, be the head coach at Georgia. Well, as Auburn's seemingly close to wrapping up a deal with Vince Dooley, Georgia steps up and re-ups the deal, make the deal better for Vince to stay at Georgia. And Vince had a really good program. He had Herschel Walker coming back, so he decided to stay at Georgia. Well, then Pat Dye reverses course as the Georgia job is not going to be open. And Pat says, I'd like to go to Auburn. And of course, the oldest rivalry in the South is Auburn, Georgia. And there's the close proximity of those two schools, certainly while being rivals, certainly something that Pat Dye looked at as a great opportunity. So he worked hard again behind the scenes to get the Auburn job, and he got it. And as the rest, they say, is history, because he did such a wonderful job going to Auburn, kind of bringing an identity to Auburn, as they had some successes against Alabama, but for the most part, they were second-class citizens in the state. Pat Dye changed that. Now, it coincided with Bear Bryant finishing out his career. But in the second year, Pat Dye beat Bear Bryant, and he went on to have great success. I coached against Coach Dye, and his teams were tough. Man, were they tough. They were physical. They were great on defense. They run the football. Big, physical. and he put Auburn, you know, and this was before the splits of the conferences. We had a couple of matchups. We had the earthquake game when I was at LSU. He was just a great football coach and did a great job building that program and putting Auburn basically on an equal level of Alabama. Now, Alabama is still the more popular school in the state overall, but Auburn was big time. So that's kind of how his career went. And as he was the athletic director and head coach at Auburn for a while. And then he was just the athletic director and was very involved as kind of the quasi athletic director. The shadow athletic director as it was called. He pulled a lot of strings behind the scenes and had his place out in the farm and, you know, loved life, enjoyed his time but was a really good guy and was very good at his players and actually got into trouble with the NCAA with some of the stuff that he did. On Wednesday, we lost Johnny Majors, and Johnny Majors was a great running back at Tennessee. The year that Paul Hornung won the Heisman Trophy at Notre Dame with a 2-18, the two great running backs, Johnny Majors had a great year, was more deserving than Paul Hornung to win the Heisman. So was a running back from Syracuse by the name of Jim Brown. Both had better years than Paul Hornung. But Johnny was a great player. His brother was a great player and died young. Johnny Majors had got a coaching job under Frank Broyles at Arkansas and had a young assistant with him, young graduate assistant, Jackie Sherrill. And then Johnny gets the Iowa State job and brings Jackie Sherrill with him. And then Iowa State over to Pitt. And, of course, they did great things at Pitt and won the national title and had Tony Dorsett and Hugh Green and Ricky Jackson, a lot of great players. And definitely left a better team than he took at Tennessee and may have left another championship or two there. Goes to Tennessee back home because Johnny played his football at Tennessee. Grew up in a little town playing football. I mean, a little town. I mean, there may be like 1,000 people in the little Tennessee town that Johnny grew up in. Three of his brothers, all three played pro football. All three were great, not just played ball, but were great college players. Dad was the coach at Suwannee. University of the South is what it was called. Or it was called Suwannee before University of the South. And was a guy that did good things at Tennessee, took a while to build the program, and infamously for the 92 season had some heart issues, went out for heart surgery, and Philip Fulmer steps in. The players respond to Philip, start to play better. Philip was really good at working the boosters. Johnny was tough to deal with. Coaches that worked for him didn't like him. Tough to work for. Boosters didn't like him. So as he's out, players start to play well under Philip Fulmer. They beat a really good Georgia and Florida team. Things going better. Well, Johnny Majors shows up a lot sooner than he was supposed to, coming off the heart surgery, the fear that, hey, he's losing the team. Comes back, and the team immediately goes flat with him. And then, of course, as it ends up, they parted ways with Johnny Majors at the end of the year. But, you know, had a lot of impact on a lot of people, a lot of coaches he worked for and that worked for him, and he did a really good job with a really good program. So we say goodbye to both of them think about what they contributed to a lot of folks. And these are two guys that grew up in the Deep South, in the heart of racial tension, yet there's something, and I'm not saying all coaches are great or all coaches or, you know, do things the right way. But these are two guys, along with many others, that they didn't look at the white player different than the black player as a person. They treated him well. Now, you, Nick, can never know what's in somebody's heart. They might think things a certain way because they grew up that way, but they showed compassion and understanding. And while people may be different, a lot of people are different. They may look different. They may talk different. They might have different views. But just because they're different doesn't mean they're not good. Who the hell says that you are good, that we are good, that somebody else is less than me because they're different than me? That is the heart of arrogance. That's at the heart of being insensitive. That's the heart of being less of a human being, and probably something we need to be better off of as a human being that approaches things. So I felt it was important to address some of this stuff today because it's really affected sports. And, you know, we've had a situation with an assistant coach at Clemson, now the head coach at Florida State, that's dealing with certain things that they got to explain things. Drew Brees, for as much as he will apologize, some people will not forgive him. Some people, no one will forget it. Some people will move past it. Some won't. Some people, just like that, will see Drew Brees not as the great player and philanthropist that's given up so much money for good causes, but for somebody that was tone deaf on this issue. That's unfortunate. Is it right that their reputation is ruined because of it? I don't know that it is. I just know that some people will see it that way. Are they wrong for seeing it that way? Perhaps. Are they right for seeing it that way? I don't know. Perhaps. You know, what you do matters. And better late than ever, maybe Drew Brees, maybe each and every one of us that maybe have thought things a different way for different reasons in a different time could perhaps look at it and say, you know what? I understand a little bit more today than I did yesterday about how somebody else might feel. And maybe there's something I can do to make somebody else feel better about themselves, to make them feel more inclusive, to maybe step in when somebody else is not getting treated well. It's all things that we need to look and think about during this very difficult time. I hate doing these shows, but then I guess I like certain aspects of it. I don't know that I like it because it's always about something that's happening that's not been good. And it's not something that I'm really good at because I'm not the best in terms of overall views of life. I'm not the overall philosopher. I just, you know, around sports, there's certain things that you feel, that you believe, that you see, that maybe can help be an example for the rest of society. So whether it makes a difference or not, I don't know, but it certainly means something to me in terms of hoping that as we go forward with what has been, I'm just going to say it, an awful first half of 2020, dealing with a virus, dealing with this, we have to go forward, be stronger, be more sympathetic and understanding to others. That is the key, and we'll see how that plays out. So, folks, we appreciate you joining us. Again, if you got any questions, send it to me, and we'll address it here on this podcast or any of the other podcasts or any of the other forums over at LandryFootball.com. But got a question here, send it to me at Contact Chris, and we'll address it right here on the Landry Football Podcast. We appreciate you joining us, and we'll talk to you again next time. Be safe, and we'll talk to you next week.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Landry Football. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is an MMA report with Jason Floyd and Daniel Galvan quick fix on Radio Influence.
My number one fight is clear, and there's not even a second fight that comes even close to my anticipation. My number one fight is Aljamain Sterling versus Corey Sandhagen. And as I'm looking, I've got the, you know, the stat sheet in terms of both these guys right in front of me, Daniel. And I saw this a couple of days ago, and it blew my mind. You think of Corey Sandhagen, you think of this taller bantamweight. he actually has a 1-inch reach disadvantage in this fight.
That's amazing. Because Sanhagen is so big for 135 pounds. It's crazy. His reach advantage is that's nuts. You know, and he's 5'11", by the way, compared to Aljamain Sterling, the Funkmaster's 5'7". So, you know, the reach has been something that Aljamain has used to have so much success, especially if you watch his fight against Jimmy Rivera. Poor Jimmy, man. He could not get inside. It was just a rough, rough fight for him. And it was Aljamain's combination of his reach and his like hand speed. Dude, this dude is so fast. In addition to just his normal like straight punches, he can rock you like a back elbow and in a blink of an eye. It's unbelievable. Or he'll do a strike and as he's bouncing back, boom, a spinning back strike. And so that speaks to his speed, but also his reach. And when you think of Sanhagen, you are right, Jason. You think of that big time frame that allows him to have a lot of success as he does his, you know, his Dominic Cruz impersonation. Dominic Cruz, you know, one of his favorite fighters, and he fights like him in terms of always switching stances, always feinting, always doing something. This fight is awesome. Both these guys could fight for a bantamweight title tomorrow, and I have gone back and forth on who I think is going to win this fight. But you're right, unequivocally, this is the best fight we've gotten, and it's probably the second best fight the UFC's put on during the pandemic, if I had to guess, behind Gaethje and Ferguson. I don't know if I'm missing an obvious one.
The MMA Report with Jason Floyd and Daniel Galvan can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.